KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 13th annual Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. American Indian Day is a traditional showcase and celebration of American Indian and Alaskan Native cultures and community, which raises awareness concerning the challenges that Native American people face in this country. This event features vendors, educational booths, food, entertainment, and more. Again, that's Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square, 700 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Literary Arts, presenting civil rights activist DeRay McKesson, September 20th at Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, featuring a conversation on culture, social justice, politics, and progress. Tickets and more information available online at literary-arts.org.
Welcome, dear listeners. This is Preference. I'm your host, Alan. Or you can call me Hedda. I'm good either way. Before we get started today, I want to make an announcement. Thrill the World Portland happens every October. This is our 12th year doing it. We'll teach you not just the Thriller dance from the Michael Jackson video, but a longer version to fill up the song. It's a great event. We did it as a benefit for SMRC, Portland's Sexual Minority Youth Resource Center, for a long time. Now it is a KBOO benefit. It's the last Saturday before Halloween. Look us up on the internet, Thrill the World Portland. Got a couple sites out there. You can gather some information, and we'll teach you the dance. We'll have practices all throughout October. So Thrill the World Portland, we look forward to seeing you. And we draw a good crowd, so 150, 200 people every year. So it's pretty exciting. We are going to talk today for the first part of the hour about Worlds Apart, Worlds Reframed. Images and Voices of the Queer Diaspora. It's an exhibit coming up here in town. I'm going to let the folks who are involved in this introduce themselves to you right now. Farnoosh?
Hi, folks. My name is Farnoosh. And good evening. And thanks for having me today. And I'm Persian. I'm part of this art project. And it has been like 3 years, I believe. And I'm so happy about it. I want people to know my story and others' story that is part of, that they're part of this project. And yeah, so I'm glad to be here.
Thanks, Farnoosh.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. My name is Maya Vivas. I am a ceramic sculptor, a performance artist, an activist, and co-owner of Ori Gallery. Ori Gallery's mission is to elevate the voices of queer and trans artists of color here in Portland and around the world.
Wonderful. David?
Hello, everyone. My name is David Robinson, and I am a writer and photographer, also an activist. And I think the reason we're here today is to talk about Worlds Apart, Worlds Reframed, which is a project that sort of came to me about 3 years ago, the one that Farnoosh was just talking about. And so I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to talk about it and have voices join in and discuss what we've learned.
Before we get into what Worlds Apart, Worlds Reframed is and is going to be coming up, let's just give the details to first. Where and when?
Okay, that's easy. So there are a couple of exhibitions. So my exhibition, Worlds Apart, Worlds Reframed, opens on 2nd of September at Concordia University at the George R. White Library and Learning Center, and that's on the Concordia University campus. It's September 2nd through September 30th. There will be an opening reception on Thursday, September 6th, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., and there will be at least three of the participants in the project will be there to both present or speak and to answer any questions that visitors have. Then the following night, there's a pop-up exhibition and artist talk, and that will be at Ori Gallery, at Maya Vivas' gallery. And that will be featuring a Ugandan artist and activist who came to this country and sought asylum and lives in the Bronx now. And Babiria Lila is coming to Portland specifically for this project, and we're lucky to have acquired three pieces of her work to show at Ori Gallery.
We're very excited.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
And she'll be giving an artist talk that night, too.
That's great. I believe we also have Victor Mukasa on the phone. Is that correct? Victor, can you hear us?
Yes.
Do you want to welcome to Preference. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're grateful. Do you want to tell us a little bit about who you are?
Well, my name is Victor Mukasa. I'm a trans person, 43 years old. I have lived in the United States for 6 years now, initially as an asylum seeker, and now a permanent resident. I hail from Uganda, where I lived most of my life. In my adult life, most of what I have done has been human rights defending, with a focus on LGBT human rights. And I've done that locally in Uganda, and then on the African bloc, and later on internationally. I am here in the United States for safety. While I live safely in the United States, I lead an organization here called Kuchi Diaspora Alliance, with the main aim of amplifying the collective voice of the African LGBT movement, and currently focusing on education and economic empowerment in general for the empowerment of the African LGBT people.
Wonderful. That's the Kuchu Diaspora Alliance. Thank you, Victor.
I beg your pardon?
Repeating the name, Kuchu Diaspora Alliance.
Kuchu Diaspora Alliance, USA.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thanks so much, Victor. Thank you too. Yeah. So let's talk about World Apart, Worlds Reframed, Images and Voices of the Queer Diaspora.
Thank you. Yeah, so I have to go way back. I have to go back to late 2014 when one day, one morning, I don't know, I started thinking about my many friends, my many Ugandan friends. I started thinking about what happened after the anti-gay bill was passed into law in Uganda. Suddenly, many of my Ugandan friends, who I had known since 2012 and some before, had to leave Uganda. And suddenly I realized, oh wow, I know a lot of people who have suddenly become homeless. They've had to leave because of their activism, their sexual identification, it was all LGBT based, but suddenly occurred to me that I knew a lot of refugees and asylum seekers, and they had gone everywhere. They'd gone to various European countries, to Canada, to various American cities. And as I was thinking about it, I was like, do other Americans have this experience? This was right before the refugee crisis of 2015. And, but even before that crisis, we had all heard the negative connotations and the talk about the anti-immigrant talk and anti-refugee talk. And it just exploded in 2015. So late 2014 is when I first started thinking about, do other Americans know this is happening? And sometime in 2015, I talked to Victor and a couple of other Ugandan friends saying, I'm really curious about this. I want to do some, I thought I was going to write an article about it. That's how this idea came to my mind. I thought, oh, I'm going to pitch an article. I'm going to write a 3,000 word article or maybe less. And so I talked to a few Ugandans and thought, oh, I know I'm going to write something. So I pitched the article for maybe 3 or so months. And fortunately, no editors responded. I was dismissed. They said, I'll pass. And that's a really a good thing, because as I proceeded, I realized I didn't know squat. I didn't know anything about this situation. And along the way, one of my Ugandan friends, who I can't remember which one, said, they asked, why are you only speaking to Ugandans? This phenomenon of queer displacement is far greater than just Uganda. It's even greater than East Africa. It's greater than Africa. It affects people from all over the world where homophobia is prevalent. And laws are being made to push people out of the country or to legalize murdering them, basically. So that, turned on a light in my head, and I thought, yeah, I need to reach out to others. So that's when I started, I joined several groups on Facebook. A lot of people knew someone who had sought asylum in this country, and I would reach out to people and ask if they were interested. And at that point, I didn't know what I was doing. I was saying, I think I'm starting a project. I thought I was writing an article, but I'm really curious. I want to know what your experience is. I thought, I had all these assumptions. I thought, America's failing at this, whereas Denmark's doing such a better job of receiving queer asylum seekers and refugees. And so I started off with some ideas, which I realized were just my ideas and not reality. But I met, I went down to San Francisco, bought a ticket, went down to San Francisco and met first with a Russian and a man from the Congo, and a bi woman from Cameroon. And that was sort of how this project started. We spent 3 days talking. I went to a couple of retreats with them at the University of California at Berkeley. And that's when I really realized I didn't know anything about this. But it began to form in my mind that I wanted to try to create a platform through which or by which these individual stories would be elevated, and that they could tell the story themselves. It didn't need to be me. it didn't need to be a journalist jumping in and saying, oh, this and this is happening. But really the essence of the stories, what brought these individuals here? What have they experienced? What are they, how has the systems of seeking asylum and coming to this country as a refugee, how are you supported? How are you failed? And I just found that very interesting. So I, you know, realized I didn't have the money to do this. And fortunately, one of my artist friends told me I should apply for a RAC project grant. First time I did, I was not given a grant. I kept going. That's about the time I met Farnoosh. The first time I met Farnoosh was in December 2015. And through the Pride Foundation, I was able to get your contact information. We sat down and we talked. Mm-hmm. And then the next year, I reapplied for a project grant. I received some money so I could pursue this because I really saw it as something not just people who are in the United States, but people who are in European countries. I wanted to capture some of those other experiences to sort of contrast what is happening. What is this experience of displacement, queer displacement? What's it look like in Denmark? What does it look like in Austria? What does it look like here, Canada, et cetera? So that's when the project formed, and I started locating people who would be interested in telling their subjects. And the whole point of this was, I think I said it a moment ago, to really create a platform that people's stories could be told in their own voice. Whatever piece of their story they wanted to tell, I was going to take a photograph for some people, a portrait showing their recognizable, their face or other recognizable features were okay, but for some people it wasn't okay. But many people were seeking asylum at that point, and even some who have been granted a permanent status are still not able to show their true identity. So through the process of meeting with people over the past 2 years, I have we have worked together to figure out what part of their story is important to them to tell and in what manner. Then another component of the project was to any of the participants who were creatives, I wanted to help facilitate a way for them to share their story through their creative work. And so Farnoosh is one of them, does a lot of sketching. And then we have a participant in the project who is from Uganda, and she's also an artist and an activist, Lila Babiria. And I only knew of her marginally while I was in Uganda, but once she came to this country, we became closer, and I went to New York to meet with her. And so as soon as I realized that the biggest part of what she does in her work is try to talk about the LGBT situation, how queers are viewed in Uganda, I realized not only do I want to help create this platform for her to share her story however she wants to, but I really wanted the work to speak for itself because that's what's important to her. So fortunately, I talked with Maya about a month ago.
I think so. Yeah. Initial email being like.
Yeah, out of the blue.
Out of the blue. I was like, who is this?
Do you really know her? Yeah. Do you know Lila Babiria? It just occurred to me that I wanted to bring some of Lila's work to Portland and have that shown. And I became aware of Ori last year when it opened. And in fact,
we opened this year.
Okay, this year,
yeah,
right.
February.
Actually, I say last year, I'm thinking when this project was postponed. We were supposed to have the show in February, but it was postponed by Concordia University. And I say last year because the year had just changed, but Victor, who's on the phone with us now, had flown to Portland because he's also a participant in the project. And when I realized the project was postponed, I had this ticket for Victor to come. Victor and I said, yes, he wanted to come. We had some other projects of his that we wanted to discuss. But Ori had just opened the day before, or maybe 2 days before, something like that. And I took Victor to Ori Gallery, but it was closed. It was closed that day. I don't know if you remember the time, but we peered in the windows and we thought, because I had as a trans person, I knew it would appeal to him, that this new idea that had just opened in Portland. So that's sort of when the seed was planted in my head for the separate exhibit, pop-up exhibit for Leela, that it would be the ideal location, because this, I mean, you should talk about Ori Gallery. I won't do that.
Yeah. I mean, when you emailed me, I hadn't heard of Leela or her work before. So I did my Googles, and I was enthralled and fascinated and very excited by the prospect of having her work or her presence, even like her physical presence in that space. I mean, that's why I created me and my co-director, Layla Hale. That's why we opened the space. We opened the space because we were frustrated with, the art world in general. When I think about who is represented in these galleries, whether they're small galleries or big galleries, if you look at their roster, there's no one who looks like us. And if there is a show that is about us and our stories, I'm talking about queer people of color, it's kind of marginalized. It's like, this is a gay show, you know? And so we end up becoming this spectacle. So I wanted to create a space where we were not some like specialized thing, like spectacle, but I wanted us to be the norm. And so it's been really good. The community response has been amazing. When we opened up in February, we had a line out the door of folks trying to get in our tiny little space. So the community response has been amazing, and we are happy to be a resource here for the community. Not only do we do exhibitions, rotating exhibitions that feature queer and trans artists of color, mostly Black people, mostly Black femmes, femmes of color. But we do workshops. We have equity trainings. We have taught places like Por Que No equity trainings, like How Not to Be Racist 101. You know, like. and I taught a queer and trans POC figure drawing course. That was really important to me because when I was going to art school, when I would draw these models, I was just drawing like skinny white. white women. So I'm like, where's the diversity in bodies? Like, all bodies are beautiful and all bodies deserve to be represented, put on a pedestal, mm-hmm. and to be seen as like something worthy of being recorded as art. What else? I'm doing a figure like a drawing 101 course. Yeah, so we are much more than just a gallery. We try to be a community center. Mm-hmm. And a gallery and just a place of gathering. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's exactly why it stood out in my mind. I mean, I watched what was going on. I went to the exhibit after Victor left. He was only here for a few days, but it really tied into my mind as this would be a perfect place if we're lucky enough to get Leela's artwork here. We already knew she was coming, but to get her artwork here, if she could have this show, because of the work will speak for itself, and then she's also going to give an artist talk.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm speaking so much. I want Victor and Farnoosh to get in here. I invited Farnoosh and Victor to join us today when you, Alan, reached out to me. Thank you again for offering us this time and space. But I wanted Victor and Farnoosh to come and speak because they are participants in the project. They have been from the beginning. I talked with Farnoosh in December 2015. That was the first time we met. And with Victor and I met a long time ago, dating back to Uganda years. But the first time I went to Baltimore and talked with him, I think was it June 2015, Victor? Do you know?
I just remember it was around the protest after the election.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that was the second time. I remember taking a train from D.C. When I was there visiting Pepe, and I went up to Baltimore and saw you. And then I came right after the Women's March. And I left the Women's March or the next day and went to Baltimore and spent some time with you and your family. So I brought both of these individuals because of the project. I've realized in the process of doing this project, at first I thought it was going to be an article, but then I realized I didn't know what other people's experience was. And also I didn't have a right to that experience and to tell that story. And, I'm a white male, a white American born in the United States. I have that perspective. As much as I like to look beyond that worldview, it's still part of me. We're steeped in it. And so what I've really wanted to do is open up the door to allow the to invite the individuals in the project to speak and share whatever part of their story they want in whatever manner. So I'm so glad both of you are a part of the project and you want to speak. And I guess, Farnoosh, would you be interested in?
Yes.
We're talking about Worlds Apart, Worlds Reframed, Images and Voices of the Queer Diaspora. It's an exhibit at Concordia University in the library beginning September 2nd with an opening reception on Thursday, September 6th in the evening. Farnoosh?
So I'm so excited about the event that is coming up, and I will talk about, I will give a little bit speech on that day. So, and then people will see all the stories and, everyone. So hopefully everyone come. And so excited about that. Mm-hmm.
So I was hoping that you might tell us a little bit about your experience of coming to Portland.
Oh, my experience.
And, that I've seen that experience over the course of 3 years. You know, you're now an American citizen.
Yes.
And you're also married.
Yes.
To your wife.
Yes.
To Jack. And so it's pretty amazing to see what's happened since I met you in December 15. And I know your process began far before that. So if you...
Right.
I know you don't want to repeat yourself. This is a line in your story that's so important to me. Farnoosh said to me once, I'm tired, I don't want to repeat myself. So I wanted to invite you to say anything that you any of your experience or either in the project or that's happened in Portland. I'm curious.
So yeah, I have been here in the United States for almost 6 years, 5 years and a half. I came January 2013, the refugee process. So I was in Turkey before that, and then I came here, and so I became citizen 5 months ago, and so finally the whole process just finished, after I got my citizenship, but still. Living with fears here, even in this country these days, as a, how can I say that? There are many things about people of color, non-native speaker, homosexual, disabled, so all the things. So still living with fears and still not comfortable with the environment and people here. So, and especially at my job, also I work at 211, it's a call center, the resource center. Always at work, I feel more about fears, and because I don't know if the person is talking to me, they're gonna attack me because of my accent or because of my race. They cannot see me, but when the moment that they realize that I have accent, so they treat me different. And so it's kind of I'm telling you, even I'm here, I am citizen, but I people don't treat me the same way that they treat other citizens. So I was talking to my friends, my other Persian friends, and I said should I carry my passport everywhere that I go? Because people should know that I'm citizen and should respect me the same way that they respect others. That's my biggest things. The biggest thing these days that I'm dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I love seeing this exhibit come to Portland, especially because, and Victor, I think you're probably well familiar with this. One of Oregon's most unfortunate exports has been Scott Lively, who spent the 90s attempting to make queerness in Oregon not a thing as much as he could, to beat back a number of ballot measures. They were all close. Eventually, Scott and friends took off for Africa, in particular Uganda. Victor?
Yes, I'm here. Your voice is kind of low, but what is the question that you
asked? Victor, it's David. He was mentioning Scott Lively and how Scott Lively went to Uganda after, and you know the backstory. I mean, Scott Lively tried to pass all these measures in with the Oregon Citizens Alliance in Oregon, anti-homosexuality bills, measures to get it on the ballot.
Yeah.
And we defeated him here, and he went to Uganda, and that's was sort of how the anti-homosexuality bill, Bahati's bill, came about. So I think he was just sort of segueing to show that, you know, it started right here in Oregon. We pushed Scott Lively and his hatred out of our state and thought it went away, but our garbage basically went elsewhere and created this very harmful law and rise in homophobia in your country that actually caused you to have to leave the place you love.
Yes. Unfortunately, our fellow citizens do not have that story. In fact, they imagine him to be one of the very important people in the United States. They hardly knew that he's a reject in his own country. It is indeed because of the influence of evangelicals such as Scott Lively that pushed me out of the country. I had been working in the movement, founding the movement, and many organizations and programs it started around 1998, but it was really low. But officially in 2002, I started coming out, as an activist. And of course, this had a very big effect on my life. And my safety, security were compromised. Socially, I was rejected. In every sphere of life became very difficult, and that led me into, living in what I call the gay ghetto. Gay people, LGBT people became my family to death. And as the spaces grew, I took my activism to a national level from just a little area in Kampala, and until, it took off across Africa. But the biggest thing that actually exposed me was when the Ugandan officials raided my house in 2005 and confiscated my organization's materials and personal property in a bid to find evidence of me being a homosexual. I sued the Ugandan government in the courts of law in Uganda. And a case that I actually, together with the guest that they found at my house that was brutalized that night when they raided my house, we won this case. Indeed, it was the first of its kind in Africa, minus the case of South Africa, where an LGBT person brings a case of violation of human rights against LGBT persons, against their government, and they actually won. So around that time, my profile as an activist actually was raised so high that even if initially it wasn't the government after me, it was now clearly the government after me. They regarded me as a threat. A presidential advisor actually one time called me for discussions and told me, "We see you as a rebel right now. You are embarrassing our country. You are painting this picture of Uganda as a horrible country for its citizens. And I ask you to do one thing. Drop the charges against the government and leave this country. We will be happy to support you. You have that option. Or stay in this country and face the consequences." Lucky enough, because of the profile of that case, I had the support of international organizations, including Amnesty International, the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, Human Rights Watch, and others. And I had good support from donors that they put me into what they called a security system. I had to live in safe houses. So I stayed inside the country 2005 and part of 2006 in hiding without seeing the sun, not being able to go outside for even a walk or to a market to buy something to eat. However, I was lucky to be invited to work to join the team at the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, which has its headquarters here in New York, but had set up an Africa office. So I left Uganda for South Africa to work, because what I was trying to avoid was seek asylum anywhere. I felt that my struggle is in Uganda, is in Africa, and that I was not going to leave that struggle. So working somewhere would mean that I have the freedom to come back if I am brave enough. And indeed, I made several trips back home whenever needed. I was leading Sexual Minorities Uganda, and in 2007, I handed over leadership to the current executive director, Frank Mugisha. And when I left the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, I joined the Coalition of African Lesbians in Johannesburg, South Africa, where I worked until the end of 2011. Now, at the end of 2011, I decided I was going back home. I was going to live outside the city, keep a low profile, and just come whenever called upon by the community. However, things were different. My friend David Kato had just been murdered early that year. It wasn't a very good situation for me. I was living in fear, because I was receiving threats. I was receiving death threats through letters, through emails, through text messages, including threats to torture my family. In fact, I received a text message where the person said, I quote, "We are going to find your children. We know where they are. We shall rape them in front of you and kill them in front of you until you stop doing what you're doing." Now, these things threatened me so much. And what was the last, the last straw on the camel's back was when an informer, basically double informer, informed us, also informed government, somebody who was used by the evangelicals when they were planning the tabling of the anti-homosexuality bill, came and told me exactly what was happening. And he told me, look, Victor, whether you're in the country or not, whether you're speaking out or not, the government of Uganda knows you as the brain behind this movement. They know you as a threat. Your life is not safe. You know, we had a conversation about all that and the things that he was made to do in order to betray his own community. And then I started fearing. I really started fearing, because something had happened to somebody that I knew very closely, David Kato. And now, similar threats are being even given about my family. In fact, one time I went out at a bar, a queer bar, where I thought, we could be safe. And a man who had never come to that bar was caught attempting to hit me with a bottle. A beer bottle, filled here bottle. And David, you can testify that beer bottles in Uganda are weapons. They are weapons. Like, if somebody hit you with that bottle, you would not survive. But somebody just held the hand just before it landed on my head. And I knew that that was an attempt to assassinate me. And I said to myself, what other sign am I waiting for? I decided to speak to a few people here in the United States, and in about a week and a half, thankfully, I still had a visa. I left the country for the United States. And lucky, which is not the story with so many asylum seekers running away from persecution in Africa, being an international activist, I had already made a lot of connections with people across the world. And so even in the United States, I had a place to stay, which is different from many people that have come for safety in this country. So I stayed at that place, but, within a month, I knew that my life had changed. America invited me to be safe, promised me safety, assured me of safety, which I was given because I was able to go to a farmer's market on a Saturday. I was able to go to a store to buy my own things without having to send somebody. But America also told me that I'm not really a human being. In fact, here in America is when I felt the dehumanization, where I was not allowed to work without a work authorization card. I was not allowed to do anything because I do not have, because I'm not an asylee. So you're given the safety, but you are told to beg. You are forced to beg, you know, and all those things work on your dignity, your self-esteem, make you feel worthless, useless, nothing. And so, although it was not enough, the dignity that was taken away from me in Africa, the leader that was left was taken away from here. Indeed, I begged. I felt I was a beggar. And, you know, to debt, the tables turn when you come to this country. You become nothing, even within the human rights movement. You become nothing because you do not have a story that can make headlines. Because the police is not arresting you here. So international organizations do not see you anymore as a tool of advertising what they do. So you're dropped here and they go on to the next victim of homophobia in Africa. So I ended up working at an airport as a wheelchair attendant. In Tibet, I work as my main job as a restaurant, you know, back waiter or, you know, server assistant, which I am grateful to have because life is not easy here in America. And on the side, I continue to chase my passion, my dream of a free LGBT Africa, where someday I know that I will return free because I have failed to embrace the United States as my home. I wake up and my spirit goes straight to Uganda. My body stays here and serves the American community in restaurants, but my spirit is still at home. My struggle is at home, and that is why I continue to mobilize my fellow activists in this country to come together so that we work for the betterment of the situation in our countries, so that someday we can go back either to celebrate the victory or to continue with the fight that we started.
Thank you so much, Victor. David, do you want to?
Yeah, I do. I thank you so much, Victor, for saying that. I mean, you really covered a lot of territory in that. And I think, I mean, both in what Victor and Farnoosh and so many other people have shared with me, Victor, you just really connected the dots again. I mean, one of the assumptions I had when I began this project was probably no one was coming to the United States because they wanted to. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a question that I asked everyone. I asked you, Farnoosh. I know I asked Victor. I asked, you know, all the, 29 or so people that I spoke with over the course of 3 years. You know, because that is the prevailing propaganda in this country and also in Europe and in probably Canada, that, you know, these people are coming for our way of life and our benefits and our money and, you know, things like this. And I can tell you that every single person I spoke to, they didn't want to come. They'd go back today if situations were such that they could live at home safely and not be persecuted, not be extorted, you know, all the numerous things that can happen. You know, the fact is, the individuals that I spoke to, they all left because they wanted to survive, and that's why they're here. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, you're developing lives here. I mean, Farnoosh is now married, has become an American citizen. Victor has brought his family, his daughters, 8 and 18, to Baltimore. It took, what a sacrifice. I think they were separated for 2 years, 2 or 3 years, Victor?
4 years.
4 years, 4 years. They were separated. And now, you know, they've been able to come together in the United States under family reunification, the very thing that Trump has denounced. You know, and Victor is this person who came to this country so he could survive. And, of course, that means bringing his family here. What made me very interested about this project and why I realized although I was over my head in it, I realized that I had to pursue it, was because these stories matter. These stories tell us what we don't know about what causes displacement. And I was particularly interested in, you know, I mean, there's an international refugee crisis, but not as much as talked about in regard to LGBTQ people. What is specific to queer people? How are we received when we come to another country, whether it's Europe or Canada or the United States? I wanted to find out. And so I've learned a lot in this process, and what I've learned has come directly from the participants. And so in the project, what we're trying to do is share some piece of that story. Each participant has, you know, we took a photo, we worked on a story, I recorded several interviews, and then sort of boiled it down into something that would fit on a single page placard. And then sent it to the participant and said, this is what we talked about. Does this cover what you want to say? If not, change it. And so we would sort of bounce it back and forth until we came up with a story that was important to them. And that's what's going to be featured at the exhibition at Concordia, is portraiture, photographs, and stories that have been created through this collaboration. There's also going to be a video that a Malaysian transgender woman and I worked on over a couple of years. And then at Ori Gallery, there's going to be one of our participants, Lila Barbilla, who is an activist and an artist, is going to come here and show her work. And her work is all about what it's like to be a queer person and considered rubbish in the country of Uganda, and that's what she uses. So I'm really excited about the work.
Wonderful. So where can folks find the specific info online about Worlds Apart, Worlds Reframed, Images and Voices of the Queer Diaspora?
Where? Well, that's interesting that you ask. We are working on a website right now. It's not quite finished. I guess it's close enough. I might get killed by my website designer, but it's close enough that I'll go ahead and give the address. But basically on the website, there is these stories and photographs, and the video will be available, listing also the exhibition at Ori and Concordia, and all the team players and sponsors. I mean, RAC and Pride Foundation, Eyes on Broadway, a few others have sponsored the work in this project. But the website is www.queerdiaspora.org. Mm. And it's not quite finished, so if you go there tonight, you're going to see a mostly completed website, but I'm hoping that in the next 3 to 4 days it'll be completely finished. So return to it again, please.
All right. The exhibition, Worlds Apart, Worlds Reframed, is a Concordia opening September 2nd. That is...
Opening September 2nd through the 30th, but there's an opening on Thursday, September 6th, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Farnoosh will be there. Also, Lila Barbiria, the Ugandan artist, will be here. And also, Alexander Amoshkin, who is a Russian man from the Bay Area, he lives in the Bay Area, he'll be up. So these three individuals will speak and be part of the opening. And then the following night is a pop-up exhibition and artist talk at Ori Gallery, and that will take place Friday, September 7th, 7 p.m. to 10 p.m.
Yeah, and if folks want to hear more about Ori and our programming and how you can be a part of any of the workshops or classes, or if you're an artist and you would like to submit work, just go to www.oriartgallery.com.
Wonderful. Thanks, Victor, for joining us from the East Coast. Thanks, Farnoosh, Maya, and David, for being with us in the studio. We're going to be back in a moment. We're going to talk about Butch is Not a Dirty Word. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Preference, I'm your host, Hedda. We were talking with folks about World's Apart, World's Reframed, Images and Voices of the Queer Diaspora. It's a exhibition at Concordia that opens on September 2nd, and there'll be a reception with artists on hand next Thursday, and then on Friday, a pop-up gallery at Ori Gallery on Mississippi Avenue. So there's another event happening in Mississippi Avenue. I'm going to introduce Esther Godoy, who's joining us here in the studio. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
Yeah. First, let's start with who you are.
That's a broad question, my friend. My name's Esther Godoy. As you said, I am Australian-born, Portland-based. I'm the editor and producer of Butch Is Not a Dirty Word, which is what we're here to talk about tonight. It's a print publication.
Wonderful. So, what is Butch Is Not a Dirty Word? It's issue number 4. That's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, we're at issue number 4, which is surprising, as it was never really supposed to go past issue 1. It wasn't ever supposed to be a sort of continuing magazine. It was supposed to be a one-off project that was going to act as a sort of coffee table book. And I lived in Australia at the time, and Butch certainly is a dirty word in Australia. It's sort of used to denigrate people and to put people down. So as somebody who identifies as Butch and that was living there at the time, it was super difficult. I think that as a masculine of center person, I think that it's expected that you walk through this world with, general society sort of sticking up their nose at you or being mad about your existence. But when you're copying that from the queer community itself, I think that's where it becomes really painful because, you know, if you're not accepted by your own people, then it sort of really starts to make you question about whether you're acceptable or not as a person, as a human. So it's a pretty long story. I came back and forth to Portland for about 6 to 8 years before I was able to move here. And obviously it was a much better experience for a butch identified person in Portland. The time that I was forced to spend in Australia those last few years, I sort of rustled up all that frustration, that negative energy, and just wanted to do something that was able to communicate my experience, not only through my own words, but through the voices and words of people both in my Australian community and my US community, just as a resource for other young folks to sort of have, just so they know that, for lack of better terminology, it does get better and there are places out there where you're acceptable. And yeah, just sort of to have that information.
Do you have a sense that Butch is appreciated in a different way here in Portland?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question about that. First of all, it's appreciated at all. So that's something. I think the experience I had as a young person coming here, I had so many mentors and I had so many people in my community who just like accepted and loved me for who I was. That's not an experience I had in Australia. I think that at that time, Australia was very stuck in the idea that we didn't need to look queer or we didn't need to look like dykes to be queer. Like we could move on and be more like hetero presenting people, you know? So to walk through that space, you know, as a flaming dyke presenting human, that wasn't deemed to be socially value in that space at all. In fact, it was deemed to be a real negative. It was sort of like, you know, you guys are putting us back 10 to 15 years. Like, what are you doing? And it was, yeah, I just felt very invisible there. And it was a very contrasting experience to then come to the States, Portland, particularly, specifically, and to just sort of be really celebrated in my existence. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you are hosting the launch party for Butch Is Not a Dirty Word. That's mm-hmm. next...
It's this Thursday.
This Thursday
coming, yeah.
Gotcha. At Mississippi Pizza.
Yeah.
So just a little bit down the street from Maya's Ori Gallery.
Uh-huh.
I know that one of the folks speaking is one of my favorite people in the world, Jewel Robinson.
Oh, yes. She's lovely.
I mostly know Jewel from just bumping into her in our neighborhood.
Yeah.
I think that might be the only time we interact is just wandering, you know, we happen to be out and about and bump into each other.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's how we met, actually. I think it was at one of the big-time grocery stores.
Uh-huh.
And there was sort of an instant recognition of queerness, and Jewel just started talking to me.
Yeah.
Just.
She's so lovely. She's got such a massive personality. And we photographed Jewel for our intergenerational issue, which was issue 3. And we sort of, in that issue, we spoke to a bunch of butch elders and a bunch of very young butch folks in their teens, and we sort of bounced the stories off of each other so we could see what, you know, what it was like to be butch now versus what it was like to be butch, you know, 20, 30 years ago, and to compare what has stayed the same, what has changed, all those things. So I'm really looking forward to hearing her speak on Thursday night. Her piece for issue 3 was fantastic, so she'll be doing a live reading of that.
Who else? Who else do we have on
hand? Oh, man, off the top of my head, I'm terrified I'm going to miss somebody. But we've got, okay, so we've got Na Akua, who is a spoken word performer from Seattle. She was on the cover of issue 3. We have Petrichor Parker there, a trans butch woman from Portland, Oregon. We've got Anissa Rashid, and their story is absolutely fantastic in issue 4 as well. It's a tearjerker. Who else? We've got Kristen Cooper-Bender. Sorry for the pronunciation if I got that wrong, but they're a fantastic comedian in Portland, so I'm really looking forward to their sets. We have, there's more. Who is up? I'm going to be doing a little spiel. Oh my goodness. I have to take a look on my phone, I think, because I know there's two more that I've forgotten. Oh, Misty Miller. I think she's a local person from Portland. And who else? We got Jewel. I think that might be it. Okay. There's 6 people in total. And we got Summer Russell DJing afterwards. So after all of the serious live readings and the tear jerkers, we're going to have a bit of a fun party time with some beers and some music and some dancing and all that kind of jazz.
And the theme of Butch is Not a Dirty Word is, issue 4 is?
Yeah, it's the love and sex issue.
All right.
all the good stuff.
And if folks can't make it out to Mississippi Pizza this Thursday for the reading, mm-hmm. where can they get a hold of Butch is Not a Dirty Word, Esther?
Okay, so we sell both digital and print copies online. So there's like a vast of different sort of costs for those. Some are lower, some are higher. I want to make it as accessible as possible to people. It's butchersnotadirtyword.com, and then just click on the store. Or else the other really good place to find us is Instagram. We have a pretty big following on there, so that's where we do most of our promo.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So that's Butch is Not a Dirty Word launch party for issue number 4.
Yes, correct.
Mississippi Pizza Pub. Uh-huh. 7 p.m. this Thursday. We just have a quick moment. Do you want to say just a couple words about what your understanding of the diverse experience of being butch that sort of makes this magazine come true?
Yeah, I think it's so different for every single person that you talk to. And I think that's something that's at the core of the magazine. And one of our values is like, we're not here to say who or what butch is. It's completely up to the individual. I pretty much say yes to anybody who asks to be in the magazine. Anyone who aligns with that identity at all is welcome. And I think we're living in an interesting time where there's so many identities out there. There's so much to identify with. So it's really interesting to hear the stories of people who do identify with that terminology, and that's what we're about.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Esther, for joining us today. Again, that's the launch party for issue number 4 of Butch is Not a Dirty Word, 7 o'clock this Thursday, Mississippi Pizza Pub. Up next is Calculated Conversations. This has been Preference. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Short Docs on Sunday, September 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Mission Theater in Portland. PDX Short Docs will show multiple short documentaries by local filmmakers, followed by an audience Q&A. There will be films about the Me Too movement, the Palindrome World Championship, an urban farm, the Oregon coast, and much more. Again, that's PDX Short Docs on Sunday, September 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Mission Theater. 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KBOO is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KBOO will be hosting Coal Miner's Daughter, on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. This film from 1980 chronicles